Okay, let's begin then. Let us all take a moment to bring our palms together, to make our veneration to the Perfect One, the Undefeated One, the Unvanquished One, He who is the fount of all wisdom and the source of all compassion, the Unblemished One, the Perfect One. Let us remind ourselves that this is not a mere mark of our veneration or us paying obeisance. This is a pledge of allegiance that we take upon ourselves, an oath for our own selves, for our own benefit, as we make a promise and a resolve to ourselves to walk the path that has been laid down to us by our great teachers, to achieve Buddhahood, to walk the path of nobility and to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So with that in mind, let us chant the Namaskara, seek refuge, observe the precepts, and invite the countless sentient beings to whom it is our duty to make this opportunity available, so that they may come and be amongst us, listen to the teaching of the Buddha, rejoice in this wonderful merit that is about to happen in this holy precinct, and may all these efforts help us to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Permission from the Noble Triple Gem, the Mahasangha, Venerable Silmanian Mahansa, and devotees. So the whole nation was a funeral a couple of weeks ago. There was nationwide devastation. People often wonder, when bad things happen, why it is that bad things happen to them. Funnily enough, people don't ask that question when good things happen to them. They don't, do they? Why is it always I who wins the lottery or gets the promotions? Why is it always I who gets the increments? Why is it always I that people praise, honor, respect? People don't tend to ask these questions. It's funny, isn't it? But when bad things happen, then they ask this question. Why is it bad things always happen to me? So somehow when bad things happen, nature has a way of always directing them at you. But good things, apparently not. They just happen randomly. That's how you feel, isn't it? Good things happen to you just randomly. But bad things happen to you because nature spites you. Nature hates you. And God doesn't love you. And He despises you. So you always sends bad things at you. This is because our minds don't like certain things. Our minds don't see all events as just events. Our minds don't like to process all things as just incidents. In and amongst incidents, the mind likes to see accidents. So the mind is not equanimous. Yes, a disaster did occur. I'm not denying that. But there's a bigger disaster that most people are blind to. The disaster that happens to us day in, day out, from the moment you came into samsara, coming into samsara itself, no one that wasn't born died that day, did they? Everyone who died was someone that was born. Don't you agree? So then, what was a true disaster? Death? Because that's inevitable. We call that a disaster because it happened in ways that people didn't expect. No one expects to be drowned in a flood. No one expects that. No one expects to be burned in a fire. All people like to die, most people like to die, a natural death. Now if I asked you, how are you planning on dying? Don't ask things like that, Swami. I said, come on. You've only just started the sermon. Well, haven't you planned your death? No, you only plan life, right? You don't plan death. You only plan your life. So when you bring a child into this world, mothers, fathers, you don't plan for their death, do you? You only plan how the child is going to be born, and then how you celebrate life, and the many years that the child is going to live and grow up and outlive you. Isn't that your expectation? That your children will always outlive you? Isn't that why you're always disappointed if the unexpected happens? It's always that. See, the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, none of these events actually bring any suffering. None of these events bring any mental suffering. Physical suffering, I get that, yes. If you're drowned, no, not that any of you have had this experience, clearly, but if you drown, then that's a very physically painful experience. I can only imagine. If you had to hold your breath for any length of time, then you will know how uncomfortable that is. Now imagine as your lungs get flooded with water. So one can only imagine that must be a very physically tormentous experience. But the problem is, it is not just the physical pain that people are worried about. Because we are all going to die, one way or the other. That just happened to be the way that some of them died. When people are talking about the number of deaths, I ask someone, just check on these available information sources, how many people die every day in Sri Lanka? So every day, around 300 to 400 people die anyway. But no one talks about that. That's not a national devastation. That's not a national disaster. But on that day, due to the floods, approximately the same number of people died. So, and then everyone's talking about it. I'm not trying to undermine or belittle the pain, the anguish, the hurt that would have occurred in the hearts and minds of the people who were affected by the floods, either directly or indirectly. I'm not undermining that. In fact, I'm addressing the problem here. That is what I'm doing. Because today it's a flood, tomorrow it's a wildfire. The following day it's going to be an earthquake. So every day these natural disasters will come, one way or the other. You call them natural disasters. What about when your heart gives up? What kind of disaster is that? Is that some kind of unnatural disaster? If you get an aneurysm, a blood clot in one of your vessels, arteries, isn't that a natural disaster? That's also a natural disaster. And then your internal organs start giving up, your lungs give up, your heart gives up, your spleen gives up, your liver gives up, your bladder gives up. All of these things that you have, they all give up at some point or the other, right? Is there any part of you that doesn't give up? You don't give up. That's the only part that doesn't give up. So when we feel that it's nature who strikes, we somehow personify nature. Sometimes we call her Mother Nature. When she attacks and takes away something that is precious to us, be that our life, our house, our property, our children. When she strikes, we say that's a natural disaster. But when your heart gives up, that is not a natural disaster. Is it not the same effect? So like I said, every day 300 to 400 people die every day in Sri Lanka alone. Now Sri Lanka is a very small country. We only have about, 22 million people population. Now if you consider the whole world, I'm sure someone can just quickly do a search and tell, let me know. What are those two things on the side of a plaster called? What the total mortality rate is globally. So, is that not a natural disaster? Aren't all disasters natural disasters? Well then, I have an even better question for you. Why do you call them disasters? So you win the lottery. That's good for you, but for you, someone who doesn't like you? Someone who doesn't like you very much, to them that's a disaster. That's why they go around cursing you when they get to know that you won the lottery. You've got your eyes set on a girl, someone else marries her. Then, good for them, but for you, disaster. You've got your eyes set on a house, you want to buy it, you've done the visit, you've gone around, you've started negotiating with the sellers or the, what do you call them, the estate agents and so on. And then they bring you and let you know, sorry to let you know, but the house is now off the market. How much? No, it's fine. But see, my question is this to all of you, to this audience. Why do we call them disasters? Because the tabloids call them disasters. Because the newspaper calls it disasters. Because media call it disasters. So this word disaster, it has a ring to it. And it sends fear through our system. We dread disaster. We don't like disaster. Because that's the image that has been painted in our minds. That like somehow it's something bad, it's something terrible. See, for as long as you keep looking at disasters through that light, ladies and gentlemen, you will forever live in fear. The only place disasters occur is in your mind. Otherwise, it's just the natural order of the system. When there are too many files on your computer, what do? And you want to create some space? Is that a disaster? You delete some files and you make room for more. That's what you do. That's just the natural order of the system. Now if there was some force above, right, that kept the whole system in order, creating new files, making amendments to certain files, deleting other files, by files you know what I'm talking about here, right? To them, to whoever that force might be, no disaster has occurred. This is just the natural order of the system. But when we don't like certain things, and we like other things to happen to us, now we have disasters and we have... What's the opposite of a disaster? Joy? Okay. So then there are joyous moments and then there are disasters. But the media will always tell you that a certain disaster has happened. Now when the tsunamis came, right, everyone talked about it. And even to this day, there are probably every yearly, like there may be commemorations around the country and many parts of the world talk about disasters. When all of that is going around us, we forget that the greatest disaster of all is happening within our hearts all the time. That's why I started by saying, a couple of weeks ago, the whole country was a funeral. I can assure you that many sons would have cried, would have grieved the death of their parents. Many daughters would have done that. Many husbands would have grieved the death of their loved ones, their wives, and wives would have done the same about their husbands. Pet owners would have grieved the loss of their pets. House owners would have grieved the loss of their property. Once again, I'm not belittling that. I'm actually speaking on their behalf here. Because if they don't do anything about it, this is not the end. This is not the first one, this is not the last one. There will always be incidents such as these. But if you don't accept them as merely incidents, in our minds we will fear them, we will grieve them, we will worry about them, and we will have sleepless nights. But that is not what you are born for. The Buddha's teaching is to help you process all incidents as mere incidents. See, there will be, have been a lot of talk about death in the newspapers. See, a lot of people talk about death. What does the word death bring to your mind? Fear, sorrow, right? No happy feelings. Say death is not considered something positive. But when you delete those files to make room for new files, I mean, you do it very, very happily because it's what you have to do. So if we were all just files on a computer, hard drive, then whoever the owner is will have to delete some of us from time to time. The problem is we can't look at all these things objectively. We always put a subject into these incidents. Every event has a subject. That's the problem. Can I ask you a question? If it is that we live in a country, let's assume that we live in a certain country, this is a make-believe thing, we live in a country where every year a certain number of people have to be beheaded. Okay? And they get picked from communities. Now let's assume that it is your turn this time. If someone came up to you, let's say the king or the king's men, who are the executioner and his people, they came up to your house and said, right, come on, it's your turn, let's go. Right? Would you not rather that it was your neighbor whose turn it was instead of yours? I mean, put aside the fact that you hate your neighbors, you don't like them, noisy neighbors, I know. No, not that. That's not what I'm talking about. Would you not rather that it was someone else's turn? Would you not rather it was someone else's turn? This is because to you, not everything is equal. Each life to you is different. Whose life is most important in this world? See, you all have the same answer. That's the funny thing. No one agrees with me on this question. Although you all have the same answer, the answer is this. When I ask you whose life is most important, you will spit out the same word. But although the word is the same, you all mean a different person. So when the good lady over here says mine, she means herself. But the lady next to her will say the same word, but she means herself. And the same applies for everyone. So whose life is most precious? So if it was someone whose turn it was, I mean, someone had to put themselves forward, someone had to volunteer to, you know, this year, it was their turn to go, each one in this room would say, no, can you ask someone else in the room, please? So when you say that, what you're saying is, my life is more precious than someone else's. But then that person says the same thing. My life is more precious than someone else's. So no one here is prepared to take the leap. No one here is prepared to put themselves forward and say, yeah, I'm prepared, I'm ready to go. But when nature decides that three of you have to die today, no one's ready, right? Let's assume there's a prophecy that the staircase is going to collapse today. I hope it doesn't. I really hope. I cannot make prophecies, right? So this is just... right? So the staircase is going to collapse. And it's destined that 10 of you will die today. Is there anyone in this room who is going to volunteer? Unlikely. Very unlikely. No one's going to volunteer. By which what you're saying is, my life is more important. I mean, let's, you know, this is non-negotiable. 10 of you have to, will have to. It's non-negotiable. If it's not you, someone else will have to. So somehow 10 of you will have to die today. So then it shouldn't matter really who, which 10, right? Shouldn't matter. But what does your mind tell you? What does your instinct tell you? As long as it's not me, I don't mind who it is. Then you say, as long as it's not my family, I don't mind who it is. Then you'll say, as long as it's not me, my family and my friends, I don't mind who it is. But then you'll say the same thing about everyone in this community, because you're all a community. You feel some connection to each other. Therefore you have your people. So then you might even ask, Swaminarayan, why can't they pick someone who is not part of the Rajagiriya? Why can't we have someone else, just not the Dharmishtha Rajagiriyans? Then you might even suggest something like this. Let's say that every day 10 people who live in this country have to die. You might suggest something like this. Swaminarayan, sir, I don't know whether this can remain in the sermon, but we'll see. Swaminarayan, sir, why don't we pick 10 people from the prison? How dare you? I mean, they're bad anyway. Right? They're terrible people anyway. They're evil anyway. They've committed sins anyway. So if anyone has to go, and 10 people have to go, why don't we start with the prisons? See, someone might actually suggest something like that. Let's assume that they're on death toll. So they've been given the death sentence. Why don't they go first? Anyone who's on a death sentence, let's send them first. And then the rest of the inmates in the prisons. And then you might say, let's send the old ones first. I will say above 80s first. So ask the above 80 whether they'd be happy to volunteer. Ask the above 80s whether they'd be happy to volunteer. No, but you're quite happy to let them volunteer, right? You volunteer them. You'll say, leave the children behind. You'll say that. Leave the children behind. Let the children go last. Because they have a long life ahead of them. And they're only just starting out in life. They're just so innocent. And they're so, they're just so helpless. You know, we just leave the children behind, send the adults first. And among the adults, who do we send first, the men or the women? I mean, let's come to some consensus. So who are we going to send first? Of course, the? Huh? See, the men remained silent in that question. Because they know that if they had said women, no dinner tonight. So the men are wise. They remained silent to that question. No dinner tonight then, if they had said women. But the women, on the other hand, they quite happily volunteer the men. See, men... is this what they promised you? When you took them on and took them home, is this what they promised you? Now they're quite happy to volunteer you? See, I ask you this question again. How do you discriminate like this? So somehow, let's put the order. So people on a death sentence, they're the worst. Then there are the prison inmates. Then there are the above 80s, the old. You tell us don't discriminate. You do all the discrimination anyway. So it's bad to discriminate against the blacks and whites, right? We mustn't discriminate against blacks and whites. But what about this discrimination? And then, so after the old, then men. Then the women. And finally the children. That's the order, isn't it? Or you might even say, well, you could even put maybe the patients in hospitals. Swami and Mahansa, tread carefully. If they're paralyzed, or if they're in a coma, now we can send them first, can't we? Yeah, let's be reasonable, right? So their lives are less worth than these lives. So this is the order of the worth of a life, isn't it? How do you discriminate like that? Why is it, I ask you, when they said that we have to take 10 people today, why didn't you not put yourself forward as number one? Why do you always... what's this? Death sentence, prison inmates, old people, hospitalized, so people in the hospitals, then men, women, children, and then me. So me, it doesn't matter which category you're in, me always comes last. Why? Think about this. Think carefully about this, ladies and gentlemen. This is the reason you're still in samsara. I'm not talking about morality here. I'm not talking about right and wrong or righteousness, justice. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm trying to get this point across to you because this is why you're still in samsara. You discriminate. If they had to work on children now, right? So the men are gone, women are gone, now it's children. Whose children? Other children first. Actually, why don't we send the handicapped children first? See, when I say that, your faces go, not nice, Samyas, not nice. But when push comes to shove, that is what your response will be. When you're at that moment, when you are there, these are some of the things that will come to your mind, unless your child is handicapped. This internal negotiation always happens, ladies and gentlemen. Because to you, not all life is equal. By you, I don't mean you. I mean just generally. Okay, this is not an accusation to any of you. Just generally speaking. If you're still in samsara, then this is typical. So among the handicapped, well, who shall we send first? The physically handicapped or the mentally handicapped? Come on, you know, as while we're at it. We've already said things that should never have been said, right? So we might as well go the whole nine yards. Cancer patients, let's send them. The hospitalized people, let's send the cancer patients first, right? But when it comes to that, this mercy that you have right now, because right now you're on a moral high horse. Everyone's a philosopher when the problem's not theirs. See, now you're being very philosophical. It's very easy to be philosophical when the problem's not yours. See, right now you're saying, no, Swami, no, this is wrong. This is completely and utterly wrong. How can we even talk about something like this? Stop this and let's talk about Parichasamuppada or something, something we don't even understand. That's okay, but let's not talk about this. This is morally wrong. How can you even talk about something like this? Is you right now. That's what your mind is saying out loud right now. But when it comes to it, see, when the Titanic sank, they had to make some choices. And they made those choices because some lives were more valuable than others. So if this building were to collapse and they said, right, you only have another 5 minutes to exit, then someone or whoever is going to coordinate that will say, right, these people next, these people next, and so on. Perhaps they might send the young ones first. Maybe they'll send the old ones first. Maybe they'll send the women out first. Maybe they'll send the pregnant women out first. Maybe they'll send the children out first. That's all very subjective. What's the right answer? Who do you ask to get the right answer? Who should we send out first? This is the thing. This is the reason you're still in samsara. Because there's an answer that comes in. Internally, there's an answer that comes out. When this question is asked of you, there's an answer that comes out. I'm not talking about the practical concern here. Right? You might say, well, someone has to leave first. And otherwise, are we all just going to be here and let the building collapse because we can't pick and choose who goes out first? Right? I mean, then that becomes a practical concern. I'm not talking about the practical concern. I'm talking about what your mind speaks. Your mind will always favor your desires. Your mind will always favor your choices always favor your desires. That's how you always make choices. But this is why you are still in samsara. All things were created equal. All consciousness is consciousness. But when we identify with certain consciousness as me, mine, not mine, others, theirs, and so on, ladies and gentlemen, these discriminations, they are only true in our world, the world that we create in our own minds. But such discriminations, they're not valid in the real world. We make these choices based on our own desires. What favors us, we choose. I have seen plenty of times, I'll give you one or two examples, right? There have been times where, when I used to be a layman, you get onto the bus, and assume there are two seats. When someone takes one of the seats, and there's someone else, someone who's traveling with them, maybe a friend or a member of the family, they will reserve that seat for them. So they'll put their bag on that seat, and then they'll keep it for them. So they're still out, they're going doing some shopping or whatever, and they'll be getting into the bus in a short while. In the meantime, there are people who are already standing in the bus. But they got onto the bus first. Whereas whoever this your friend, relation, they're outside, they haven't even, perhaps they're still on the way to the bus halt or to the bus stop. But the seat rightfully belongs to the person who got onto the bus because you haven't paid for that seat, right? You haven't bought a ticket. If you've already bought the ticket, then fair enough. Let's assume that's fair enough. But if the seats are equally available to anyone who got onto the bus, then they have to be made available in the order that people got onto the bus. But what do people typically tend to do? They'll put a bag on the seat and say, no, that's taken. By what? Your bag? But there may be someone who actually needs a seat. But no, that seat is for me and mine. What little do you know that that is the reason you're still in samsara? These choices. You don't realize the price you have to pay for that, right? It's not the price of a bus ticket. The price you're paying is samsara. The price you're paying is floods. The price you're paying is earthquakes. The price you're paying is storms. Because if you're in samsara, all of this comes to you. What you've just done is you've separated space, opportunity, a privilege to someone that is close to you, dear to you, special to you. So that every time you do this, you're furthering your journey in samsara. You might argue, but Swami answer, everyone does it. Swami says, everyone does it. So why is it wrong if I do it? It's just a seat. And everyone does it. So if everyone does it, it makes it right, does it? How many times when a wrong deed is committed, does it become a right deed? Now you tell me this then. Let's work it out, okay? You and I together, let's work it out. I'm just doing it multiple times until it becomes right. Come on, let's do this. You tell me when it's right, okay? Because there'll come a point, because of pure repetition, and because we've done it so many times, it becomes right. Okay? Let's carry on. Why are you laughing? What's so funny? Huh? It's wrong, is it? But if you keep doing it many times, it becomes right then, doesn't it? No? Ah. Then what about the seat in the bus? Poor choices. These choices are influenced by the people you associate with. When someone makes a choice, you observe that. And if no one speaks up, then you think that's okay. That's typically how you learn these choices. Let me give you an example. If someone shouts at you, this is, tell me what you've seen in society. That if someone accuses someone, typically what does the other person do? If someone is shouted at, what does that person who has just been shouted at do? They'll shout back, right? No one says anything about that. No one speaks up. Now imagine you're just a kid, child, you're growing up, you're learning by observing what's going on around you. Like your children see this all the time. That's why at home, mother shouts at the father, father shouts at the mother, and that's apparently how things work. So there's no parent or a grandparent there to say, stop fighting, you know, this is not what you're supposed to do, your children are watching. So the mother and the father, they set an example to the child, and the example is, when things don't work out, what you got to do is shout at each other. So the strongest wins. The loudest wins. The fiercest wins. Those who have physical power, they win. Because if verbally you can't win it, then what must you do? Pick something like a club or something, right? Or the broomstick. Pick something, anything that can be used as a weapon and attack. Until she shuts up. Or until he shuts up. So at some point, mother or the father, they will retreat. Typically, in cultures that we have seen, the mother will retreat. She'll go to the bedroom and she'll just close the door and start crying. The children see this. And so the child growing up thinks, ah, I see. That's how you got to solve problems. They're like sponges, always learning things. So you are out in the street, person gets shouted at. Then typically what you've always seen is that person who got shouted at retaliates. Usually a bit louder. Because they don't want others to think, people in their vicinity, they don't want them to think that they have been somehow mocked or ridiculed or undermined, belittled. They don't like people thinking that because their ego has just been attacked. There's one part of you that is most painful when attacked. What part is that? Is it above the neck or below the neck? Is it above the belt or under the belt? Gents? Which part is most painful when attacked? Which part? It's called the ego. It's called the ego. It's not a physical part. So when that part gets attacked, it's very important, you think, to fight back. Because the relationship that others have with you has a big impact on your ego. That is why it doesn't help, ladies and gentlemen, to be in an environment where people are always praising egos and always talking about, you know, how great and how good and how wonderful you are, and just always boosting your ego all the time. It doesn't help. It doesn't help with your journey of Nibbana. That is why when we create an environment for Nibbana, which is what we have done at the monastery, the ego doesn't get a place. If ever we see any of our students or even ourselves speak, do with ego, think, you can't see that. But if those actions are demonstrative of an ego behind the scenes, then our teachers will always speak and say, no, why did you say such a thing? As an example, let's say we all get together and do something, an event or organize something or do something good. If one of us steps forward and say, you know, I did it anyway, I did it this way, I did it that way, it was my doing and so on, our teachers will always come forward and say, sorry, who's this I who did it? What I? What makes you think you can take credit for that? And they'll speak up. Reminding us to be mindful that there was never an I who did it. It was merely our defilements that spring out, spawn an ego that makes us think that it was I who did it. That is a part of you that is most painful when attacked. And you know this. So, going back to the bus. People have done this many times, and you have seen people do this. When they get onto the bus or a train or some kind of public transport, they will reserve a seat for their loved ones. But someone else more deserving of it simply because they got onto the bus first. And that is right. So they come on and they say, can I have that seat? No, it's taken. That's why people try to rush onto the bus. Haven't you seen that? Sometimes it's like a stampede into the bus. It's like wild animals trying to get onto. Have you not seen that? Is it just I who've had these experiences? Or have you always traveled business class? Is that... You know, but in some cultures, in some countries, they have. I don't like to call it manners because it makes it sound like in the other countries they don't have manners. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying it's a very cultural thing. It's a very cultural thing. I mean, there were plenty of things that I was quite shocked. I've experienced multiple cultures. I was shocked to see certain things when I went there. There were certain things I was quite shocked when I saw when I got back here. But then I later realized, well, that is the way it works. It's not my part to try and change it. It's not my place to change it. I just have to accept it. That is the way it is. But I can accept it okay. However, I must be able to see what's going on underneath. What's really going on behind the scenes? What are these minds doing right now when they behave like that? I mean, personally, I have seen how people, they'll queue up waiting for a bus to arrive, and then as soon as the bus door opens and say, right, people in, my gosh, it's like that's the last bus. I mean, it could be potentially the last bus, but how come every bus is like that? And then suddenly they'll push people around. It doesn't matter who gets hurt, whose feet get trodden on. It's about who gets that seat. Who should get that seat? First who should get it? Me. And then? The word that was on the board up here. Me and mine. What people don't realize is, the price they have to pay for this is not the price of a ticket. What is the price? Sansara. That's a heavy price. Little do they know that that is the price they pay. That's just queuing for a bus or getting onto a bus. Plenty of other places where you just have to queue up to get something done. But people just can't wait because they always want their share, my share, their part, their turn is more important than someone else's turn. If there's a board that says last few in stock and now there's a queue, or they say, you know, price reduction, and everyone's formed an orderly queue, and then the shop assistant comes and puts another board just underneath that says last few. Now what happens to the queue? No more queue after that. People can't be happy with someone else getting something that they can't have. Let's be honest, let's speak the truth. Permission to proceed? Yes? Let's speak the truth. If you want to get to Nibbana, let me show you where you fail. Where you topple and fall. Nibbana has to start with being a good person. Goodness then cultivates greatness. But if you're always focused about what's in it for me, where's my part, where's my share, where's my turn, where's my seat, where's my thing, where's my that thing, this thing. Every time you think and act along those lines, ladies and gentlemen, you're always fostering, you're always growing, you're always feeding this beast of a me that lay dormant in your mind. You've got to be very careful. If there's a car park and there are only a few bays left, can you genuinely be happy if someone else takes your slot? Don't answer that question. It's a difficult question to answer. It's a very difficult one because there's a morally right answer and there's an intuitively right answer. Unfortunately, your intuition does not agree with your morals. This is why there's a duality inside of you. You know the right answer and then you know your answer. And these two things clash. There's conflict. So you can't do as you speak. That's the problem. I keep saying you, but I'm not really talking about you, okay? So please don't feel that the moment I sat here, I've just been attacking you. This is not a personal attack on anyone. I'm just talking about consciousness and a defiled consciousness. So if the hat fits, then put it on. I don't know whose size this is, right? I just throw the hats. If it doesn't fit, then don't worry, just keep it to a side, you might need it later. But don't throw the hat away, because you might need it later. It's like your first aid cupboard at home. You bring it and fill it with stuff. You don't just throw stuff out because you don't need it now. You might need it later. Yeah, so likewise. And this is where there's competition. Whenever there's a competition, the price you have to pay is samsara. And let's take something that is very much accepted in today's day and age, and even encouraged for that matter. Sport. Please don't be hurt by anything I say. It's not meant to hurt. It's meant to educate, meant to enlighten. Sport is good. And sport is something we must have, because it helps us to be physically fit, helps us to be healthy, exercise, and all that good stuff you get out of sport. But the moment you introduce competition into sport, now it becomes a whole new ball game. Pardon the pun. Now it's a different matter altogether. You see, isn't that why there are certain instances where you see, where you say, that's good sportsmanship? There are times when people are respected and people are honored, right? And that's good sportsmanship. Say, for instance, there's a marathon. And just before the finish line, let's say, you know, 100 yards before the finish line, one of the runners, they topple and fall. And then someone else stops, and then they help them across the finish line. And you say, what? That's good sportsmanship. So if that is good sportsmanship, what about the rest of it? So you identify individual instances of good sportsmanship. So that becomes good sportsmanship because the rest of it isn't. You only see white because the rest of it is black. That's where you see the contrast. So what shall we do? Shall we stop sport? No, shall we take the competition out of sport? It's too late for that. We can't change the world and the way it works. I'm just here to educate you. To show you that you need to be making the right choices. Otherwise, the price you're paying is not a small price. It's not a small one. Put sport to a side now. Dance, music, singing, art, drama, all of these things we have in schools and societies and clubs and associations and all that, right? We have them at school level, we have them at provincial level, we have them at district level, we have them at national level, we have them at international level. Intergalactic, not yet. It will come. It will come. So, is a mother happy to know? Or is a mother happy when she gets to know that it is not her child who has come out first at the art competition? A typical mother is only pleased to hear that her child has won the prize. And that goes the same for the child themselves. They're happy when they win the prize. So what we've done now is introduce competition into something that is beautiful. Art is beautiful. Art is meant to soften. Art is meant to introduce melody, music, rhythm into what would otherwise be a very dry and barren mind. But then, what people do is they introduce competition into it. And they contaminate it with competition. Then just as the saying goes, you know, a pot of curd and you put a bit of dung, to borrow the Sinhalese idiom. Yeah, you have a pot of curd and you put a bit of, not curd, a pot of milk and you put a bit of dung into it. The whole thing goes rotten. Likewise, You take something beautiful, something peaceful, something to unite, something to harmonize, and then you add competition to it. Then you feed egos. Wherever you see egos are being fed, ladies and gentlemen, the price that is being paid is samsara. I'm only sharing these things with you so that you can live mindfully. This is the whole objective here. You need to live mindfully. Most people will not encourage that because you will just go with the flow. At the workplace, again, there's always competition. Who gets that promotion? Who gets a good word from the boss? Who's best? Who gets onto their Christmas list? Christmas card list, rather. Who gets that promotion? Who gets that increment? People can't be happy with someone else getting something that they want. All because they don't see all things as equal. Just because you do something wrong multiple times doesn't make it right. This is where you ask me the question, but Swami now says everyone does it. So if everyone does it, what are we supposed to do now? Something else? I could simply say, well, if everyone does it, go, you know, do the same. But be aware that the price you're going to have to pay is what everyone else also pays. Surely? If you're asking me if it's okay to do something because everyone else does it, I can say yes to that, but with the caveat that the price that you will have to pay is also the price that, what? Everyone else pays. If you're okay with that, then fair dues. But I know you're not okay with that. Because you're not prepared to pay the price of samsara. Not at the cost of nibbana. Not after so many Sundays. Sundays that you could have been doing something else, spent elsewhere. But all those Sundays that you've committed to your nibbana, and then if the price you have to pay now is samsara, and the cost of that is nibbana, now you have to think twice, ladies and gentlemen. I explained to you last week, anya hila bhupanisa anya nibbana gamini. The path to worldly pleasures, worldly gains is one. The path to nibbana is at complete odds with it. 180 degrees in the opposite direction. What can I do about it? I'm sorry. It's not my making. It's just the way it is. I myself was, you know, knees deep in competition. I was there. I was at it. I wanted. I wanted to be the first. I wanted to be the best at everything I did. But then I realized that I was not happy if someone else became first. If someone else was the best. It always had to be me. And every time I needed it to be me, I was paying a hefty price. But little did I realize that. So I went to the temple, I observed sil, I gave dana, I did all those things. But there was something that just wasn't happening within me. What do you think that was? Nibbana. How could it? When what I was doing was complete and entirely at odds and against, and goes everything against Nibbana. Because ultimately, what is Nibbana? Why would you know that you have attained Nibbana? When you don't experience a sense of self. But when you put yourself in competition, and you foster competition, and you're part of that competition, and you want to compete, and you want to come out the best, you want to come out top, what are you nurturing now? The self. The very thing, the one thing that you have to be free of is the one thing you keep feeding. So then people like that will attain Nibbana when pigs fly. But why does everyone talk about then competition, and why is competition always so encouraged, and why is that the thing that we have to do? No, No one's interested in Nibbana, that's why. Because no one's heard of Nibbana. No one knows of Nibbana. It's the rarest thing ever. I asked you the other day, I think the last time we did the talk, yeah, Samanta Chakravarti Muni Rajasa. This is the sermon of the Muni, the Mahamuni. See, when he wanted to get Yashodhara, this prince, right? When he wanted to get Yashodhara, a bride that he was destined to get, did he not compete? He did. He showed off his physical prowess, right? In the arena where all the princes and the kings had gathered, and the father of the young bride, or the soon-to-be bride, was there. So it was the done thing in the day that princes had to compete to have the princess's hand in marriage. So they had to wield their swords and show that they could do that, and that they were powerful and they were strong. So the prince was there competing. And so he won. Something that he fought so hard and so badly for and won. Why did he leave all that behind and then renounce? Why did he renounce in the end? Something he had fought for so hard? Because he realized this is not the way. There's a question you always ask me which is very difficult to answer. How do we do what we always do and still get to Nibbana? That's a question you always ask me. How do we continue to do what we always do, what we are very comfortable doing and we've always been doing, and still get to Nibbana? That's like saying, Swaminasa, how do I keep walking backwards and go forward at the same time? I don't have an answer to that question. And I know that you don't like it when I don't have an answer to that question. Because I know that is what you wish for. If there was a way that you could do everything that you do right now, enjoying the pleasures that you enjoy, like going out, drinking, dancing, eating, enjoying yourself, partying, doing all that, and also still get to Nibbana. So you want to keep going south but get north. So you're wondering, well, maybe if you went full circle, you would still be back north, wouldn't you? I'm sorry, I didn't make the rules. It doesn't work like that. This path to Nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, is completely and entirely different to the worldly way of existence. Because for worldly existence to be successful, there has to be competition. There has to be. People have to be self-concerned. They have to be self-conscious. They have to preserve themselves. It has to be like that. That's when the survival of the fittest will always happen. So the weak must always be quelled, so that the strong will survive. And then among the strong, again, another round of quelling and survival must happen. So therefore, as this cycle goes on for many times, now you have a very strong group. That is what must happen for this world to survive and the world to thrive. So there's always the strong that gets elected. That is why the weak among you will fail. Be that at the workplace, at school, in life, in marriage, in finance, in business, in commerce, the weak among you will always fail. But people will always keep fighting. And they'll talk about equality. They'll say, just because I was born weak shouldn't mean that I should not get every opportunity that everyone else gets. and then they will lobby for it, and then they will justify that, and they will excuse me they will try and get as many consenting voices as possible, and then they will legalize that and say, right from now on, shouldn't matter whether we were born weak, we should still be able to have every opportunity, just as much as the strong ones. And then we call that civilization. So we're all civilized. Because it's not the law of the jungle anymore, not the survival of the fittest, it's survival of the smartest. So now we're very smart. All the while trying to compete. So that I can have what everyone else also has. Why is that a problem? Why is it that you can't have what someone else has? Why is that a problem? Because I'm the most important one here. And if I can't have what they have, that's not right. So justice has to be restored. Am I sounding like gobbledygook? Is this making any sense? Is it? I don't know. Is it making any sense? Okay. But I'm sure you've never heard these things before, because these are not things that people will entertain. These are not things that people will want to hear, or people will want to have said or spoken. This is forbidden. You must not speak such things. Because this discriminates, apparently. But no, this is not what discriminates. Discrimination is when you stand up, when you rise up, and you say, because I am this, everyone like me must also have the same platform. That is discrimination. See, the women among you will say, I'm a woman. They are men. They can do this, that, and the other. How come we can't? This is very fragile ground now, isn't it? No dhani also today. So, a woman will, quite legitimately feel this way. I'm a woman. They are the men. They get to do this, that, and the other. How come I can't? How come I don't get to do it? And then you can speak on their behalf, you can talk about it. Sometimes there will be men who will come and support you as well. They'll support you. Because they'll feel, yes, that is true. It's only right that women also get equal opportunity. The point is, we can argue for that. We can lobby for that. We can also get it ratified and legislated and all that. The problem is, every time you make an effort to equalize this, the price you are paying is Nibbana. We can get them all on the same platform and as equal partners. We can do that. It's not impossible. We can do that. And it's getting closer to that. Those days I used to think, there may still be the glass ceiling. The glass ceiling? Not about the glass ceiling? Yeah. So a man and a woman could do the same job, but it's a ceiling, but it's glass. So you can't, it's just transparent. No one knows why, but because you're a woman, you can't get equal pay. You can't get paid as much as a man does. And so let's all speak on behalf of our women, so that we can also get equal pay. And it's possible to achieve that. If we all spoke enough times, then it's possible to achieve that. See, if we did this enough times, if we did this enough times, it becomes correct. Doesn't it? I think I've just made enemies with all the women in the room right now. Don't look at me like that. in my previous life, meaning in my lay life, I would have come and spoken with you. I would have gotten onto the stage and talked on your behalf. I would have said, absolutely, women should have the same rights as men. If they can work together, if they can do the same number of hours together, then how come they are not paid the same? How come they don't get equal opportunities? How come they don't get promoted the same? How come they're not recognized the same? I would have done that, and I did do that. So back then you would have seen me as someone who fights for women's rights. Today I don't fight for their rights, I fight for their freedom. I don't fight for women's rights anymore. If that's what you want from me, then I'm sorry. Today I don't fight for your rights, ladies. I fight for your freedom. Freedom from that mentality. The mentality that always digs at your heart, that always bothers you, that it's never enough. That I must also be lifted up to the same level as everyone else. And I'm not just talking about women, I'm just talking about in general. Now, even in a group of among men, you'll still have this problem. If you take a bunch of men, right? Men are always comparing with each other, the cars they drive. No? Ask your hubby when you get back home. The cars they drive, the houses they live in, the arm candy. One of the things they'll compare. The amount of money they make. The club that they play golf with. These things are, they're silent, but they're always comparing inside. The watches they wear, the shirts they wear, the brands that they wear, the shoes they wear, the glasses they wear. That's how they come branded. But no one speaks of these things. Because people don't realize that there's a problem, there's an underlying problem that's eating away at your Nibbana. It's like the wound under the, what do you call that, the dry part? The scabs, right? Yeah, so it's like the wound under the scabs. It's never treated. It looks like everything's okay. All the way down to the bottles they drink. That is also compared. That's why in the, the showcase. I don't know whether they do it now, but in those days, they used to have the bottles they drink all lined up. So when visitors would come, they can see, oh, he drinks this, he drinks that, it must be a big shot. So even among men, you see this. What they don't realize is the price they pay. And that is Nibbana. And so because people don't realize the price they pay, now, then again, to give more, to give more food or to add more fuel to this fire, people will come up with like these clubs and societies and associations, and they'll make it as exclusive as possible. So that's where you have these exclusive clubs and societies and associations. And then they give you these nice fancy badges. Right? Only awarded to members. And then they come in different colors as well. So first you have the bronze, then you have the silver, then you have the gold, then you have the diamond, then you have the platinum. And those badges can be attached to your car. I hope I'm not speaking about any of you here. This is not a personal attack on anyone. I walk with my eyes closed, ladies and gentlemen, okay? You can see when I walk, I look down. So I don't know what car you come in. I don't know whether it has got badges. I don't know what brands you wear. This is not about you. I'm only here to speak the truth. Permission to proceed? Whew. One of these days I'm going to get a letter saying, Swaminas, you need not come again. You are rocking our boat. But this is the ugly truth that no one tells you about. Is it not time that someone came and gave you the merits that you have sowed? Mustn't someone come and show you that something's wrong? Because you're always wondering, how come I'm such a good person but I'm not getting to Nibbana? What's the deal? Of course you're good. But behind the good, there's a lot of bad that happens. But you're blind to it. That's why you need a teacher. A teacher who once wore your shoes. Who was in those shoes once. That's why they say, it takes one to know one, and I know what it's like because I was there. I was at the gig. I wore that t-shirt. I smoked that pipe. Not literally, but metaphorically. I was there. So I know what I went through. I know how when I bought my car, it was a fancy car. I wanted to show off. Those days I would never have said that I wanted to show off. But now I'm not embarrassed to say that, because I know that that wasn't me. It wasn't even the past of me. There was a mind at that time, nothing to do with me. That was Pachupanna, this is also Pachupanna. That I knew when I bought my car, how I went around showing it off to my friends and my distant family and so on, my relations. And the way that I would get into the car, the way I would get off the car and close the door. And if no one heard me, I would open it and close it again. And how I was very particular about it had to be polished. I bought it in a lovely black, because I liked it black, and I used to call it the Black Stallion. And it had to be like prim, proper, polished. I wanted to show it off. No one said anything about it. Everyone I showed it off to said, wow. If only we could. And every time they said that they couldn't, and then if only they could, that made me even happier. Because I was somehow above them. I was better than them, and that made me feel good. Where's the compassion there? Where's humility there? This feeling of pride that you are better than someone else, and you know, whenever the mind feels that it enjoys it, doesn't it? That's a vile and vicious and wicked mind, ladies and gentlemen. Let's accept that. Where's compassion then? Where's loving kindness? Where's mercifulness? Where's equanimity? Where are the four Brahmic abodes? None. It's all out the window. But let's be honest, we are all guilty of it. That sense of pride that takes over our hearts and we are consumed by it. And it makes us feel good. There are people out there who don't have as much as we do. Sometimes we like it so much. We like it. And then what we tend to do is we go and try and we support those people. Sometimes we support others because it gives us a good feeling that they are below us. So we draw a line as to how far we help them up. We'll help someone for as long as they don't go above us. That is where you draw the line. This is what the mind is like. You will help someone for as long as using your support they don't rise above you. Because the moment they rise above you, now you are small again. Does that make you feel good now? I'm not suggesting that everyone's like that, but this is very common. When I got my job at the bank, I used to go around telling people, I loved boasting about myself. Because, you know, they were my contemporaries at university, you know, they were getting out of university, they were getting like, you know, basic jobs and things like that. And it made me really good to tell people, that, you know, I'm working in the bank. I'm a banker. and how much my starting salary was and all that. So, you know, we'd ask people, like, what are you on? What are you on? What are you on? I literally realized what I was on. I was on something else at that time. It was called ego. But kept asking people, what are you on? And if someone said that they were on something a little bit more than what I was on, I'd say, is that with bonuses and things like that? Or is that the basic package? So if they made more than me, that was a problem. So now, because I had lost the competition. Now I had to do something to raise myself above. Oh dear, yes. Yeah, I say these things to you, ladies and gentlemen, because I want to show you what the Dhamma can do. It's done miracles. I don't even recognize that old fellow. He's dead and long gone. I don't even recognize that guy anymore. Just the thought of him makes me puke. But such are minds that are laden with ignorance and ego and pride. Therefore, I could not see all as equal. I could not be happy to know that someone had more than me, better than me. I would never say anything, because it would be wrong to say that. You mustn't, you know, like, you can't say, how dare you earn more than me? You mustn't say. What must you say? Oh, wow, congratulations. That's great, what a great achievement, you know, well done. How did you manage to get that job? You would ask that. But behind the scenes? That's what you'd be doing. So were we equals? No. If we were equals, then I should be happy with their gain, shouldn't I? See, if you met a guy, I'll ask the gents in the room, if you saw a guy with a girl who used to go out with, who you used to go out with, and she gave you the boot. It wasn't you, she gave you the boot, okay? In this example. And she gave you the boot, but now you see a guy going out with her, and now he's having the time of his life. He's happy, he's joyful, like he's just, you know, they're just like lovebirds. Right? They're so much in love with each other. They just can't get enough of each other. You see that on the street. Huh? And I ask you, how does that make you feel? Your tongue will speak, and whatever your tongue says will betray what your heart says. Here's what your tongue will say. Well, if I couldn't have her, then he hasn't, so I'm happy for them. Yeah. Really. You can only say that if you didn't have an ego. You could only say that if you didn't have an ego. Because I know how egos work and the effect that an ego has on the mind, right? I don't buy that anymore. Because there's no you or me and someone else. There are just minds, and minds with or without egos. That's it. The same causes will only manifest the same effect. So if I know what ignorance and attachment can do, and how it nurtures and creates an ego, and the effect that ego has on the mind, if I know that, if I have experienced that, then it can't be any different to anyone else. Yeah, you know, you'll have virtues more or less, right? You know, people are good and they have this drushti and good drushti and so on, but the ego is the same, after all. It will be very difficult to stomach that and to be happy about that, to be equanimous at least about that. Very difficult. Here's what you would want to say. If you saw that he was not happy with her, if you saw that, you know, he was also going through a very difficult time with her, that would make you happy, typically. That would make you happy because she gave you the boot, and so it is not right that now she gets to enjoy and have a good life and have a good partner. It's not right that she gets that. She doesn't deserve that. Because she gave you the boot. So she doesn't deserve that. Anyone who's done harm and evil to you must not deserve good, right? If anyone's put you at a loss, then they don't deserve to live a good life, do they? I know what your tongue speaks. I can hear that. But the problem is, your heart says another story. And I know that you don't like that it says that either. I know that. Because you're virtuous. You want to be righteous. And you want to silence that voice. I know that you do. That's why you're here. You're here to learn how to silence that voice. That evil, wicked voice that cannot be happy at someone else's gain. Especially if that gain has been deprived to you. And I know you want to silence that voice. So this is why this lesson is for you. How do you silence that voice? How do you put that voice on a permanent mute? Where's that mute button? That comes with wisdom. The wisdom that you are not an identity. That you are not special. That you are not somehow someone who deserves more or better or less than someone else. All this comparison, ladies and gentlemen, is because you are an identity, or you feel that you are an identity. Whenever we compare things, we compare identities. That could be physical things. That could be conceptual things. Whenever you compare, you're comparing identities. Uniquenesses is what you compare. You take two things that are unique and then you compare them. So this feeling of uniqueness is the problem then. That's the fundamental problem. The perception of uniqueness. Aren't you unique? Well, in more ways than one, you feel that you're unique. If I ask you to make a list of the ways in which you are unique, then you'll have countless things to say. First of all, you will separate yourself from half of the world's population by saying what your gender is. Right? Then one half is already out of the picture. Then you will talk about your race. As if that's not enough, in some places they talk about caste. Again, two. Make yourself unique. Then there'll be other attributes that you could use. Your complexion, the way you wear your hair, the brands that you associate yourself with, the status that you have in society. Am I pushing the right buttons? Let me know if I press the wrong one, okay? But you know, we all have these buttons. It's just that no one's ever pressed them before. So that's why, you know, inside of you is now like a ping pong ball machine. There's a ball bouncing here, there, everywhere. It's like hitting there, hitting there, hitting your ego this side, hitting your desire that side, and aversion here, there, all over the place. I know right now you're probably feeling like stretched in every direction. Thankfully we get to do sermons to a group and not to an individual, because otherwise it would be too painful. This is good. This format is good. But here's what you have to do while you're here. Assume that there's no one else in this room. Do that religiously. Assume that there's no one else in this room and all of this is directed to you and at you. But then if you have a falling out with Swami Nuhanse, quickly remind yourself, no, there are many others in this room. So that was not directed at me. Right? Take solace in that. Find solace in that. But for as long as you can keep going, right, and it doesn't break you, right, because what doesn't break you? Yes, it will make you stronger. So, as long as it doesn't break you, allow yourself to think that this is purely directed at you and you alone. So when I say, you have a big ego, you to look at me and go, yes, Swaminas, I know, I do. But if it hurts you, hey, did you hear what Swaminas said about you? Sort yourself out. Then assume that I'm talking about the person that next to you. So this format is good. It gives you the best of both worlds. Remember, we are all alone in this. Although we look like we are a group, we progress alone. We come together as a group, but we progress alone. So you will hear things in these sermons that you've never heard before. And it's becoming more and more so, isn't it? I don't know why people still keep coming. Do you give more than the sandwich now, at the end? Is it sausage buns also now? But these are the unsaid truths. These are the truths that your merits have availed you. And here's the thing, right? Because of your status in society, people will hardly speak these things to you, certainly to your face. Because most of you in this room are respected people in society. Either in your communities, at the workplace, right? You're respected in your communities. And that can work against you. See, like at the monastery, I'm supposed to be Nayaka Hamdru. If I'm not careful, that could be my biggest curse. If I'm careful, it can be my greatest blessing. Because people will think twice before they come and instruct me. Before they point out a fault. One, because they might think, well, you know, he's doing it for some reason. Maybe he's doing it for something, right? I just don't understand it. Because I'm new to the sasana. Someone might think. You know, a junior monk might think that. He's a senior monk, so he probably knows what he's doing. What he is doing doesn't seem right to me, but maybe that's because I'm just not experienced enough. It's something that they might think. Or they might think, well, he's senior. So he's senior, so we have to respect our seniors. So to respect seniors means we don't say anything bad to them. Personally, I don't see that as respect. I see that as disregard. To me, respect is not that. To me, respect is you respect me enough, that you care about me enough, that if you see me going down a wrong path, you will come and point it out to me out of respect for the effort that I am making to get to my own salvation. That is what I see as respect. So, coming back to you all, you're fortunate in one way to be respected, highly regarded, revered, honored in society. Therefore, your subordinates, most people in society, you'll think twice, if not many more times, before they come and speak up to you. So when you're angry, chances are you will cool down at your own pace. No one's going to come and tell you, hey, what are you doing being angry? Who asked you to be angry? You're not allowed to be angry. Because chances are, you're the one who decides whether it's time to be angry or not. So that can count against you. But what's in your favor? The fact that you're at the helm means that you can do good to many. So that counts in your favor. So this is a compromise. And then the more senior you are, age-wise, in other words, the older you are, the less people are inclined to point out your faults. So even like when we get Anagarika Mahatyas, right, to the monastery, when they're a bit older than the typical age, sometimes we are a bit careful about what we say. Because they're still settling down. They're still settling in. After a while, they just become, you know, once they become a child in their own minds, then it's okay. Anagarika, we only get it, there's an upper age limit. But with Anagarika Mahatyas, we don't have that lower age limit, we have an upper, much higher age limit. But typically we can get people who are quite experienced, well-respected, highly regarded, right? So then sometimes we are a little bit careful because we don't want to hurt them. That's why. We don't want to break them. We want to bend, not break. So bending takes time. Breaking takes no time at all. You just have to snap. But that is not what the sasana is. The sasana is all about compassion, softness, loving kindness, tolerance, cutting slack, giving them room to grow, giving them time to grow, and all that. Just as we were given, and we are always given. But so, the point I'm trying to make is, the older you are, biologically, the less people will approach you and point out faults. So that counts against you. You see, the more you age, they say, the wiser you get. But on the other hand, the less people will actually come up to you and point out your faults, flaws and weaknesses. Because in our culture, and in many cultures, they respect, you know, what do you call it? Elders. Yeah, they respect elders. So then if many of you are elderly, or that side of, shall we say, I don't know, whatever number you think of, then these may be some of the very rare instances and opportunities where you get to hear what's wrong about you and the way you think. Because you have allowed the Swaminvansi to come up on this seat and talk down to you. You wouldn't normally allow anyone, just about anyone, to come and speak to you like this. You'd say, how dare you? And usually even if you do get a speaker, there'll be a cost. So when you pay, there are certain things that they're supposed to say and there are certain things they're not allowed to say because you're the one who's paying for it. Right? But here, there's no fee. So I get to decide what I say. Because if it's free, yeah, you can't demand. Right? So that's also in your favor. I'm pointing out why these talks are beneficial. And why it's always in your interest to keep that window as widely open as possible. The more you close it, the more or the less I will speak to your heart. And the more I'll speak to your intellect. So if all I speak to is to your intellect and does nothing to your heart, then it's time you change the sermon. Find some other place or some other Swami Mahansa or whatever. Because these sermons are not to make you more intellectual or to give you more knowledge about the Dhamma, because you have plenty of that. You can just go and watch plenty of sermons online. You can read them in books. You can read the Tripitaka. Right? You can do a course on it. You can take a mindfulness class or whatever. But this is more to change who you are at your core, to transform you. And then it shouldn't matter what your age is, what your gender is, what your nationality is, where you come from, what job you've done, whether you are in business or you are in some other profession. Am I right? So then we talk about ego. Therefore, when you listen to these sermons, try and assume that there is no one else in this room, and each word is directed right at you. So if it cuts you, then let it. If it pierces you, allow it. If it bleeds a little, then let it. Don't die. Later we'll put a plaster. But if it's doing nothing to you, then maybe you've already achieved the pinnacle of this path. And you should be here and I should be there, maybe. Or maybe you've just slept throughout the sermon, if it's done nothing to you. So embrace these talks. Embrace them. Let them walk through your ears. Let them do the magic that it's supposed to do to your minds. Let them cleanse your minds. Let them heal your hearts. Because it's intended with that. The intention is that. It is given with love and compassion. Sometimes with love, although you do things with love, sometimes it can hurt. But it's not meant to hurt. Okay? So from time to time I'll remind you of this, because I just, you know, we have new people in the audience every day. They may not know who Swami Nuanse is and why Swami Nuanse says these things. And then this will be the first and the last time they come here. Sometimes they'll get up and leave in the middle of the sermon. What nonsense is this? We didn't come here for this. To be mocked and ridiculed like this. Alright, let's go back to the point. So there's a problem that is in each and every one of you. In each and every one of us. That's a better word than you, isn't it? When I say that, there's a problem in each and every one of us, feels better than in you, right? Okay, then I'll say us, okay? See? That is the price you'll have to pay for Nibbana. Because when I say us, I include myself. So it's self-deprecating to a certain extent. Therefore, you're okay with that. It feels softer. But when I say you, it hurts. Potentially. So if I say, you are all bad. I say, we are all bad. See, one feels more stomachable, right, than the other? See how the mind works? But both you and us were created where? In your own mind. So I'm not talking about you and me. I'm talking about two things that you create in your own mind. And somehow one version is better than the other. One hurts less. Oh, the nonsense that we put ourselves through, isn't it? This is why we need to awaken. Take nothing for granted and take nothing at face value. Dig deeper. This is a whole journey, ladies and gentlemen. You know, it's a journey of self-discovery. It's a whole journey of self-discovery. You are a miracle in many ways. And sometimes, you know, this whole journey is to try and understand the miracle that you are. Why you do the things you do, why you feel the things you feel, why you say the things you say, the emotions that you feel, and sometimes the things that you can't process. And then you wonder, why did I say that? Why could I not stop myself from doing that? When there was absolutely no reason for me to do something like that, it was atrocious what I did. But why? Why did I do that? And then all you have is regret at that time. These are all these human emotions that you have to struggle with day in, day out. Someday you're going to have to find out and figure it out. So this is the journey for that. And it all starts with understanding the Dhamma. Anicca, dukkha and anatta is what you need. This is self-mortification. At the end of this process, you will be dead. Yikes. Not dead in the conventional sense. The you that you feel inside you, that bugger, he and she will be dead. Because that is the wellspring of all your suffering. In the examples I gave you, you suffer there because you are somehow different and separate to others. If there's a race, there's only one answer to who must win that. It's either you or someone that you know, someone that is yours. If there's a competition, you and yours must win. If there's a prize, you and yours must win. If there's a disaster, anyone but you and yours. That is why when I ask for which 10 is prepared to volunteer, you will say, Swaminasa, can I go last, please? Whereas if there was a pudding, then you will say, Swaminasa, can I go first, please? Even if your tongue betrays your heart, the truth is that you will say one, your heart will say another, and you don't like what your heart says. You know that this is very dishonorable. It's not just what my heart says, it's actually very, it's very foul what it says. I should not feel this way. Now, let me put this question to you. So, you know, the ladies and the gents in the room, those of you who are either married or who are in relationships, serious relationships, okay? Have there never been times, and don't answer this, don't even nod, okay? Just blink. Okay, so no one else, and don't look at each other, look at me, everyone. Have there never been times where someone else has caught your attention? All right, go on, blink then. I said blink because if you leave long enough, everyone blinks, right? So, which is the truth anyway. And I know that you want to be faithful. I know that. I know you want to be faithful. And I know that you have promised to your spouse, to your other half, that I will always be faithful to you and I want to remain faithful to you and I will never even look at another person with both my eyes closed, it will only be with one eye closed. If I ever do. Something happened. Security, there's a gentleman who needs saving. I know you want to be faithful. And I know in your wildest dreams you don't imagine that you would, you know, that you would give that furtive glance. Now there will be someone else who will steal your attention. I know that you don't want it, but it happens. That's why it's not right, to be frank, where if ever you catch your spouse or the other half, right, taking the odd glance at someone else, it's not right for you to victimize them or to, what shall we say, vilify them, to make them the villain of your relationship. If you understand what I'm trying to explain to you, you will know that it's not right that you do that. Because it's not that they're being unfaithful. It's not that they've lost their loyalty. It's just their sense of self. And they're helpless in that moment. It's not that they're bad, they're terrible. And that they're promiscuous. It's not that. Because you fear the worst. One look and I know this is going to end there. In your mind, because you forecast the future. You can see your divorce. He only looked at her once. Maybe he just recognized her from work or something. But you've already projected divorce. That is fear taking over. Because whenever you have a future, you can't help the feeling of fear. Whenever you have a past, you can't help the feeling of sorrow and grief. These are emotions that live in the past and in the future. And they stem from the present. Present, past and future are all timely experiences which are creations of the mind. In fact, they are creations of the sense of self. They are creations of ignorance. So, you know, if you want to live a happy married life, which I don't know why you would want to, but in case you do, you need to be more understanding. Right? Actually understand the person you got married to. Try and actually understand that. How much have you actually studied the person you got married to? Do you know that what you've married is a mind and a body? You fail to see that. That's the problem. That's how you set this whole host of a gamut of expectations on them, and then you are setting them up to fail. Honestly, you set them up to fail. The moment you get off that porwa, you're like, no looking at others, no glances, no text messages, no phone calls, right? No late night discussions, that cushions and whatevers, right? No going out to drinks, no parties, no this, that and no hanky-panky, nothing. So you give them a whole list of things, nada. And no, you not even look at them. You can't look at someone unless you take my permission first. But to take permission first, they must have seen, right? It's like, can I look at what's behind me? Permission? What do you want to look at? I don't know. I have to first get your permission. No, what I'm saying is, you've got to be more understanding, ladies and gentlemen. You know, let me share what we do at the monastery. Right? Whenever one of our students come up to us and they say they have a problem, our understanding of the Dhamma has helped us to refrain from judging them. That's the last thing we do, judge. Because here's what we understand now through the Dhamma. It might be that they have committed something, some wrongdoing, right? But if they're in front of us now and they're here to confess, the mind that is present at this moment is something that is very virtuous and they want to do something very good, which is to confess. It is not the same mind that committed the crime or the sin or the wrongdoing. So when someone comes and confesses, the first thing we do is appreciate. Because what they're doing at that moment is such a wonderful deed. But here's what happens when you judge. If you can't stop yourself from thinking that this is the same person that committed that wrongdoing, now you feel that it is they who deserve the punishment. Punishment for what? The thing that was done. In the sasana, we don't punish for things that were done. We don't do that. Certainly we don't do that at our monastery. We teach. We might instruct the student to do something. For example, we might say, okay, I want you to go and chant Buddhaguna for the next 2 hours. That is not a punishment for what was done. It is fixing them up so that such a deed does not happen again in the future, which is a very different perspective. Because we know that there's a temperament of the mind, there's a tendency to do that particular wrong deed, that it could happen, right? But what is done cannot be changed, and besides, it was not this person, this mind, that did it anyway. So what's the point of punishing for what was done? So we don't do that. But if there's still a tendency that this mind might be inclined to do something similar at a future point, then it is our task as teachers to correct that. So we correct. That is what we do. We don't punish. And here's the benefit to us as teachers when we take that approach. When you punish, you are now thinking about the wrongdoing. What was done, what was bad, what should not have been done. That it was bad, it was vicious, it was vile, it was whatever. It was bad, it was terrible. Right? Now you are focusing on that. And therefore, if you don't like it personally as a teacher, now you have anger, you have resentment, you have all these negative emotions. Therefore, when you punish, sometimes you might punish with anger, aversion. Whereas if you want to correct, you do that with compassion. You always do it with compassion so that it doesn't happen again. Never to go back and punish for something that was done. Always to correct so that something like that doesn't happen again. One is done out of resentment, the other is done out of compassion. Now as parents, I urge you to do the same. When your child comes up to you and says that they have done something wrong, or you find out that they have done something wrong and they were not prepared to confess or whatever, but you know that something's happened, there's no point in trying to punish them for what is already done, because the past is not here. That point of time is gone. If you take punishment into your own hands, if you become the server of punishment, then you need to understand that if resentment, anger, aversion strikes your mind, then you're punishing yourself by doing that. Now there are two evils. The deed that was done, as well as the wrong you are doing now. You are doing it now as a parent. That is not what your task is as a parent. As a good parent, what you're supposed to do is ensure that the child does not commit that deed again in the future. For that, what you need is compassion. So it's always taking a positive outlook. You're always looking at how can the situation be improved? Not looking back at what happened. Let's always only use our past as a teacher to take lessons from, not to punish. So then, coming back to your example I gave you earlier. Excuse me. Too much talking these days. I'm supposed to speak as little as possible, but it's impossible during this time, especially when Guru Hamaru is out. So coming back to your family relationships, spouse relationships, right, close relationships and so on, I urge you, ladies and gentlemen, to understand that the person you are living with is a mind that has defilements. If they didn't have defilements, they wouldn't have got married to you in the first place. Enough? Agreed or not? If they didn't have defilements, they wouldn't have gotten married to you in the first place. They found you attractive, which doesn't happen in a mind that has no defilements. They found you good looking, which does not happen in a mind that has no defilements. They loved your sweet voice, although later they realized it wasn't as sweet as they thought it was. But that doesn't happen in a mind that has no defilements.
See?
So what did you marry into? Defilements. What are you expecting now then? Now you want a saint. You marry a sinner, and then from the next day onwards you want a saint. What are you talking about? See, it's very unfair, I say, if you expect anything more than what you married into. Once again, I emphasize this point. It is not that they want to be disloyal to you. You've got to put aside that way of thinking and, you know, take a more open-minded approach. I mean, if you can either choose to do this or you can choose to ignore my words. But if you take this perspective, and now you're married anyway, so there's no walking out of that relationship anymore, right? At least you can live a peaceful life. This is not me suggesting how to get your husband or your wife to love you more, right? Or to treat you better, or to give you more gifts, right? Or to remember your birthday, or your wedding anniversary for that matter, right? These are not sure and short ways of that happening. I am only here to fix you, not your husband or your wife. Like I said, who's in this room right now? Me and you, that's it. No one else is in this room. So you can come in through those doors, and at the door, you might come there holding hands, but once you enter, let go. Physically, I don't care how you sit, but I mean, metaphorically, let go. So this is not a sermon to fix your spouse. Does it say anywhere on the board? We fix spouses? We don't do that. These are to treat open minds. That is you. You have a problem. So your husband and your wife, they married you because they had defilements. Otherwise they wouldn't have married you. They found you physically attractive. Why? Because they were blind. No, really. They found you attractive because they were blind. Blind in what way? Blind to the truth. Try and interest an Arahatun Mahansa to get married to you and show me. Then I will accept that you are actually physically attractive. So if you married someone who had defilements, why do you expect them to be someone who doesn't now? Assume you are interested in a girl and she has long hair and you like that. Now I'm talking to the boys. Okay, so you bring her home and one fine day she decides she wants to cut her hair short. So she chops her hair now and now it's short. And you come back home from work. You're like, what did you do? You ask her. And she says, well, I just thought that this would be nice. You didn't think to ask me about it before you went ahead with it? No, I thought you'd like it. No! I married you because one of the reasons I married you because I liked you with long hair. So you see, if you married her with long hair, you want her to keep that long hair, don't you? You don't expect her to cut it unless she gets your consent. And I'm just taking a very simple example so everyone understands. So you expect what was there when you got married to remain? Yes or no? Ah, thank you. So then, what else was there when you got married to him or her? Defilements. Defilements were there. Raga was there. Dvesha was there. Moha was there. All the cankers were there. Sakka iditi vijayicha seelabada paramasa, all the lot. They were all there. So you don't want her cutting her hair because she had it when she got married to you. Then she also had defilements when she got married to you. So, but now you expect her to be free of defilements. Or only have defilements towards you. What kind of defilement is that? There are no such defilements. There are no such defilements. Defilements only attraction towards you. There are no such defilements. Come to your senses, ladies and gentlemen. That's why I say, understand the person you're living with. To understand that, you need to understand how minds work. So if not for Nibbana, at least come to these sermons so you can understand how to live a happy life with your spouses. Then you will eventually get to Nibbana. Once you understand that there is no spouse at all in the first place. Only a mind with defilements, with or without defilements, that's all there is. You know why he found you attractive? Would you like me to walk you through the process? Let me. Why not, huh? You've come all this way. You've come so far. Why leave it there? Let's throw the baby out with the bathwater, shall we? Excuse me. See, this was you. That was you. This was him. That's his halo. He saw you. Actually, he never saw you. That's where we have to correct. He never saw you. The you that you are, the you that you feel within you, he never saw that. How could he? Because he doesn't have a you receptor. He has light receptors, they have sound receptors, actually not even sound receptors, they have vibration receptors. There are chemical shape receptors which lead to either smell or taste. Okay? And then there are pressure receptors. But let's, for simplicity's sake, let's call it light as a sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. Right? So there are receptors that process in this mind as these: sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Not she's and hers. Not yous. So there are no women receptors or girl receptors or female receptors. None, you know, there are no receptors on this body that can perceive a female. I'm talking to you through the process of what happened. So you don't make that mistake again. Then here's what happened. The moment this I got sight. How? Light bounced off of that object. And there's a chitta. This mind was born merely to perceive sight. That's it. And by sight, we only speak of color. That's it. Color was perceived. And that color didn't come from the object either. Color is created in the mind. It uses light or energy as food to feed that process. Then a chitta was born. Now, here's what happens. This was not just a chitta being born in a pure mind, it had ignorance. Because there was ignorance, there was an understanding, a wrong understanding, a false understanding that in the world out there, there are individuals, entities. And this ignorance also had bad knowledge. This is bad knowledge, wrong knowledge, false knowledge, that you are an individual. So this you was created in the mind, not you, but you to him, meaning him, I. Now I was created in the mind. This made him feel like he was a person, an individual. This is a creation of the mind. I'm just drawing it very, keeping it very simple here. Okay, this is what we call jati. This is jati. Did that come from outside? No, that was all cooked in the mind itself. It's all cooked up here. Then, as it observed this object, this mind has drushti, views. It knows that there are things, this is bad knowledge again, but drushti can be full of good knowledge as well as bad knowledge. Good knowledge is called sammaditti, bad knowledge is called micchaditti. So there are wrong views that are associated, that this mind associates with, and that those wrong views tells the mind that there are individuals in the outside world, there are entities, there are people, there are human beings, there are men, there are women in the outside world. And so, for a need to experience this, what happened? This mind created in itself a woman out of the sight that was born. Now what it saw was only a sight, but it personified that sight. It gave this sight a person attribute, a personal attribute. Then it was no longer just a sight. It became the sight of a person. And then it used the various attributes that it also has in its drushti, like, you know, long hair, what do you call them, you know, colored lips, then thick eyebrows, eyelashes, bangles, rings, and all sorts. So it took all that knowledge, each one fitting this cast, this model. And every piece of information that was used to create, to fabricate a woman, not out there. Because there's no woman out there. This is just rice and curry. Only in a different form. That's why, you know, what makes you? Rice and curry, right? You are rice and curry. That's it. The more Asian you are, the more rice and curry you are, isn't it? No, but literally, what are you? The food that you eat. Every cell of your body is made of the food that you eat. That's why I say you're just rice and curry. But just a different arrangement. That's why our mouths don't water when we look at you. Because it's just a different arrangement. You don't come in the shape of rice and curry. So then, what this boy looked at was just an object, and in the mind was created a woman. So then, this is where a woman is born. Where? In this mind, not there. So then he took some other views as well, like how old I am. Now he's asking himself, how old am I? I am 25 plus. So it's time to now tie the knot. Then there are others who keep feeding drushti into this. Parents, elders, siblings, friends, the internet, saying, marry, 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 marry. Now it's time to get married. Settle down. You're a grown-up man now. Settle down. I start a family. It's time now. And then you look around and other people are also doing the same. So, 1 plus 1 equals 3. So, right, once that is done 100 times, it is the right thing to do. Right? So he sees everyone adding up 1 plus 1 equals 3. So he realizes, that's what I must do as well. So it becomes the right thing to do. I walk that path. I bought that cow. I mean, not... No. Now how do I dig myself out of that hole? not that. Oh, I'll stop. I hope you know that I didn't imply that she was a cow. Okay? Anyway, I sold that cow. So what I meant to say was I also walked that path. So I know And, you know, that's why I can speak to you. And I know that all of those were influences. I was drushtified. We just invented that word. I was drushtified. So get that into a dictionary. Drushtified. So, using all that drushti, now this guy comes to a decision. Because this entity is now something that this entity desires. Therefore, to always have sight of this, to have the sound of this, to have the rest of it, he realized that he had to take this woman. Is there a woman here? No. He had to take this rice and curry. What? Oh. So what did this rice and curry do? This rice and curry took this rice and curry. The same thing was happening here. Something very similar was happening on the other side as well. Therefore, it was easy to come to an agreement. So when he asked, "Will you marry me?" She said, "Oh my God, yes." I mean, you've got to add a bit of drama, right? It's no drama, what's the point? Huh? It's got to be a bit dramatic. Huh? That, come on, you got on your knee, and you held it up like that. And then there was fireworks, right? You planned it, like, it was so exquisitely planned. It was the right location. Other friends were there, pretending like they didn't know what they were there for. It was a surprise, right? And all that. It all adds to the drama of it all, right? So ultimately she said, "Oh my God, yes. I thought you'd never ask." So because all that while, what was happening in her mind? The same thing. So he got married to someone he created in his mind. He proposed to someone he created in his mind. She said yes to someone she created in her mind. Did they marry each other? Did they marry each other? No. Because the other's presence cannot be felt here. So how can someone marry someone else? This, we said, was this individual, right? This was him. And this was her, right? This cannot be felt on this end. It cannot be perceived. It cannot be experienced. Because there are no self-receptors here. Only sight, sound, smell, taste, touch receptors. No self-receptors. So therefore, these selves cannot be mutually perceived. Therefore, you can never experience another person. You can never experience the individual that another person is, or at least that you think they are. So whenever you feel that you are experiencing another individual, now when I say the word mother, right, someone comes to mind, please remember that that is not your mother that you are thinking about right now. It's the mother that you create in your mind. You create a mother in your mind and you experience that. Because all your experiences are mental. That is why you are alone in this world and so are you. There is never any overlap, ladies and gentlemen. That's why the Buddha says, Attadipa viharata. You live on an island. Realize that you yourself is an island. No one else is there with you. It's a lone island. All this thinking that she has, I have her, she has me, we have each other. That's just all these people that you create in your own mind. These are all hallucinations. So when I say the word family, immediately your mind goes into hallucination mode. And you start hallucinating things just like that. You just hallucinate. This is what happened. So this person hallucinated, she hallucinated, he hallucinated, and then they got married to their own hallucinations. But when you look at it from the outside, it seems like a marriage made in heaven. Or a match made in heaven. But when you dig deeper, you realize that is a very different story under the covers. Lift the bonnet, have a look inside. Then you will see that is a very different story, ladies and gentlemen. You are deceived all the time. This deception that you allow yourself to go through, right? It is torturous. That is why I speak against it. This is torture. Because here's what happens later on, right? When she dies, actually, she never dies. Because this is just rice and curry. This rice and curry becomes rice and curry to earthworms. And then that rice and curry becomes a tree. Isn't it? So all that happens is this form transforms into other forms. It's just a constantly cyclical process. Parts rearranging all the time. Like transformers. You know how those robots, they always transform into something? It's the same thing that goes on here. They just keep on transforming. One form to another form. That's it that's going on here. But here's what happens in this mind. In this mind, because it has entitified this arrangement, it doesn't realize that this is merely an arrangement. It has entitified that arrangement, thinks that this is an object, this is an identity, this is how it is. So then that is how this object was created. Now what happens when this formation changes, takes another form, he thinks that she is now dead. So where does death occur? Where does death occur? In the mind. Death occurs wherever jati occurs. Death occurs wherever jati occurs. Death does not occur in the outside world. In the outside world, all that happens is transformations. That is all that happens. All that happens in the outside world are transformations. One formation changing to another formation. That's it. Nothing dies. Nothing was born to die. It's weird, isn't it, this stuff? You know, you've got to rewrite the rules of life and existence and the way you perceive the world. Things are not how you always thought they were. Very different, ladies and gentlemen. Very different. That is why I always say, you create your own suffering, see? Suffering created. Now, when this formation changes, when it takes a different form, when this transforms, now he perceives death. That is why they say jati paccaya jara marana. See, marana happens because of jati. Death is a result of jati. Now, the point I was saying was earlier, if you want to live at least I don't know whether you can live a happy married life, but at least a peaceful married life, is it not time that you understood that the very reason he came and proposed to you was because he had defilements? And those defilements were based on drushti. So when the drushti changes, what happens? Right? Based on defilements, those drushti will keep changing, so then different desires will occur in this mind. See, you say it's okay when he likes some change that you do to yourself. Like, let's assume that you color your lips red, but the following day you decide to color it purple. I don't know, some random color. And then he says, oh, actually, that's very fitting. I really like that. But he never said that before. Previously, he just said the red lips were fine. So it's okay when he says that about you. But if he finds something else attractive, that's not permissible, right? Remember this and remember this well. If it's legitimate for a mind to like a rupa, attractive, it is equally legitimate to find any other rupa attractive. Remember that and you can live a peaceful married life. I don't know about happy, but peaceful married life. I speak of he, but it applies for she as well. I don't have to repeat the whole story again, right? So if she finds a particular rupa attractive, that is in and of itself enough evidence that she will also like other rupa. The fact that you don't like it is not part of the deal. Let's be honest. He didn't ask for your permission before he liked you. Beat that. Checkmate now, right? He didn't ask for your permission before he liked what he saw. So why do you say that he now has to have permission before he likes something else? How is that now part of the agreement? If that were true, then he would never have liked you. Because he would have said, I'm just considering, can I have your permission to like you? Then he would have not have asked you in the first place. See how the rules of the game change just when you like it and when you don't like it? That's why I say, you know, we've got to wake up to the truth. What you like, what you don't like is not how the world works. This world is anicca. Your iccha has nothing to do with it. You keep your iccha at home and sleep on it if you want. Your iccha has nothing to do with how the world works. Face the facts. Look at the truth. I'll say this as my last words for today. Someone who gets married or gets into a relationship, into an affair with another person, frankly, has no right to claim that they only find themselves attractive. They have no right to say that. They have no right to say that. And I have explained to you why that is. Therefore, don't make such demands. Once again, you can either choose to accept my words or you can choose to ignore them. This is not law. This is just common sense. Just not so common, that's the only problem. This is not law. You can choose to accept what you want. But if you want to live a peaceful life, a peaceful married life, which I wish upon all of you, until you find that there's a better peace somewhere else. Until then, if you wish to live a peaceful married life, please understand that you have no right to demand that they only find a particular person, a particular individual, a particular rupa, a particular sabda, a particular gandha, a particular rasa, a particular sparsha. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, attractive. Because you never demanded that they take your permission before they found you attractive. So how can you demand that they take your permission to find someone else attractive? These permissions and all things, all of those are conventions. The marriage certificate is merely a convention. Agreements are all conventions. They will strive, they will try for loyalty. They will try to remain faithful. Just don't demand of it. Don't expect it. Because if you do, you will only be disappointed. I speak on your behalf, ladies and gentlemen. Don't fall out with me because I state the facts, but this is the truth. I know this is not what you would like to hear from me. I know what you'd like to hear from me is how when he betrays you, he's going to go to the hells and suffer forever. That is what you might like me to say in this sermon. how there's going to be eternal purgatory for him and no escape. But the truth is, it is not that. That brings you no peace. Reprimand, retribution, what peace does that bring you? Punishing another, what peace does that bring you? Isn't it? So I wish you a peaceful married life. It would be hypocrisy of me to wish you a happy married life when I know that it is not possible. Because happiness is not in marriage. If it were, I would be married. Happiness is not something we need to go after. It is something that is always with us. Please try and make sense of this. So then, if you ever find your spouse looking at someone, taking a silent attraction towards someone else, stealing that glance at them, and you spot it, or you get to know about it later, what must you do as a wise person? What? It's not what your mother would say. If you went and asked your mother, she will tell you to do something very different. She will say, teach him a lesson that he will never forget. Or bring him to me and I will talk to him. But if your parents, your mother and father are now in this asana, then now your mother will say something else. Understand with compassion that this is just a mind that suffers. You married one. You married a mind that suffers. Suffers from desire, suffers from greed, suffers from aversion, suffers from defilements. It is tough being them without you telling them off for being them. It's tough just being them alone. That alone is tough enough. They don't want to have those thoughts towards another person, but they can't help it. They don't want to look at another woman or another man, but they can't help it. They'll try, and if they're strong, if they're virtuous, did I say something I'm not supposed to say? They will try to be virtuous, but, you know, if they can, then kudos to them. But if they can't, don't fall out with them. Just look at them with sympathy and empathy. Understand that this is how minds work. And you didn't demand them to be free of defilements when you married them. Because if they were, they would not have married you in the first place. Okay, right, I rest my case then. Wish you all a peaceful married life. When you want happiness, you come and talk to me. Alright, let's do the merit transfer then. Let us all take a moment then to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, by listening to the Dhamma and inviting the Swaminarayans to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive and supportive environment for all to come along and listen to these talks and practice the path such that they may achieve their own salvation. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasikas and upasikas throughout the world who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who have sacrificed and dedicated their lives to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana, as well as the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this mess to my teacher, Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by translating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery who, for the sake of merits, to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in this merits, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our teachers, our employers and our employees, as well as anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May they all rejoice in this medicine by the power of these merits. May they also be freed of any physical and mental ailments and obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadevas, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer this message to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, to those who have passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that it is in this long journey of samsara they will all have been mothers, fathers to us. Let us also transfer this message to our loved ones and ancestors who have passed away, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us transfer this message to the members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives in natural disasters such as tsunamis, earthquakes, floods, fires, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara they will all have been at some point a parent to us, a sibling to us, someone who would have helped us, supported us and assisted us in many ways and forms. Therefore, with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness towards all of them and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us, let us transfer all the merits we have acquired to all of them. May by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves from the bliss from the woeful plains and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahatiranin Mahanse in this life itself and in the era of this Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnen midatnva Desha ginnen midatnva Moha ginnen midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita-tara-vetnva Nibbana-parama-sukhayam Sukhita-tara-vetnva Mamada-siyalu-loka-siyalu-satnvayo Nibbana-parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetnva Nibbana Parama Sukhayan Sukhita Taravetnva
निब्बान परम सुखयन सुखित राग गिनी निवेवा द्वेष गिनी निवेवा मोह गिनी निवेवा निवंसत नवेवा निवंसत नवेवा නිවන්සප ලැබේවා. තුන්වන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බැලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිත දරගත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.